dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. I'm Lynn Gary. Tonight we're going to continue our series on biotechnology with some modifications. In our first hour, we'll present a panel from the Big Money Bad Science Conference that took place recently in Vancouver, Canada. The speakers in tonight's panel will focus on activism. You'll hear how Europeans have achieved GE-free food supply in just 2 years through grassroots action, about the direct action movement against biotech, and about creating sustainable and healthy food alternatives. In our second hour, local news. First, a report on Ithaca College students who occupied the administration building last week to call for the school to cancel their contract with the food service provider Sodexo Marriott because of its ties to the private prison industry. And then an interview with WEOS talk show host Nobody about his lawsuit against Cornell University, which has refused to honor freedom of information requests on their biotech experiments in our community. We encourage you to tape this program and distribute this information as widely as possible. Tonight's panel is titled Sowing the Seeds of Empowerment. The first speaker is Lindsay Keenan from the Greenpeace UK GM Free Task Force.
Please welcome Lindsay Keenan.
Hi, thank you very much for having me along. As Mary said, and as many of you might quickly guess, I'm Scottish. I'm not wearing a kilt, but something usually gives me away. The previous situation in Europe, between 1996 and 1998, we had the situation in Europe where people were asking the question, what is genetic engineering? We had the same situation you have here. We had no public knowledge about the issue. Personally, I wasn't particularly aware of it. I was a director of a natural products company in Scotland at the time. We had 60% of processed foods contaminated. We had no labelling of genetically engineered foods. We had a compliant government. We had a compliant and complacent food industry. We had a compliant or silent media, with the occasional exceptions. We had biotech industry propaganda. Does that sound familiar to you? The current situation in Europe, which has developed between 1999 and 2000, we've seen a huge public debate. We now have a very informed public in Europe about the issue of genetic engineering. We have the situation where virtually every major retailer and every major manufacturer has excluded the use of genetically engineered ingredients from their foods. We have labelling of genetically engineered foods. The labelling is not perfect, but at least it's a start. We've had a big informed debate in the media. We've seen a 40% growth in the sales and in the purchases of organic produce. In Europe just now, we have some field trials of genetically engineered crops, and I don't know if you've followed the international media, but you may have seen that Greenpeace has taken a dim view of that. And we currently have no commercial growing of genetically engineered crops in Europe, small exception of a few thousand acres in Spain, but we're working on that. We still have compliant governments, we still have biotech industry propaganda, but then some things never change. The rejection of genetic engineering by consumers. Basically, in Europe, as I say, we had the compliant government, we had the relatively silent media. What changed the issue was the rejection of genetic engineering by consumers. The rejection of genetic engineering by consumers, by you and I, forced the rejection of genetic engineering by food retailers and food manufacturers. I'm going to list you a few of the people in Europe who are GE-free just now. The health food trade. I'm glad to say I was involved in the health food trade myself. The people that sell organic and natural produce were some of the first people to take on getting GE out of our food supply. The health food trade in the UK worked hard on the issue for a couple of years and they reaped the rewards. On average, the companies that I represented gained between 10 to 20% extra market share because they got GE free and they went out and told the public about it. Within Europe, all of the major manufacturers are now GE free. If that's Nestle, Unilever, Best Foods, Campbell's, Kellogg's, you name them, they're all supplying GE free food to people in Europe. Now you may be aware, perhaps, that there's a wee double standard going on there. You've got companies like Kellogg's and all of these others who are still feeding genetically engineered foods to you guys and to your kids, but they don't feed it to us in Europe anymore because we've had an informed debate and they know they can't sell it. The retailers have rejected genetic engineering as well. Asda, who are Walmart's subsidiary and the second largest retailer in Europe, GE-free for all of their foods, including derivatives, including their pet foods, actually, as well. Tesco, who are the UK's largest retailer, as Mary introduced me there, Greenpeace asked me to work alongside of Tesco last year because they're the UK's largest retailer, the third largest in Europe, and they told us, okay, stop hitting us over the head with a big stick. Stop telling our customers that we're selling GE products. We will go GE free, but we think it's impossible to achieve. We don't think it can physically be done for a retailer as large as us. Too difficult, too many ingredients to source, too many diverse products, just physically impossible. I worked with our senior management team and their technical team for the last year. We've sourced GE free for everything that Tesco stock. As of June this year, GE free for all of their oils, their derivatives, their food additives, everything down to their xanthan gums, you name it, they're GE free, and now they're removing GE from their animal feed as well. Other retailers in UK, you've got Safeway. Please, you'll embarrass me. Other retailers in the UK, you've got household names like Safeway, Sainsbury's, Marks and Spencer's, all GE-free. And the rest of Europe and Germany, major retailers like Tengelmann and Aldi, GE-free. In Italy, S.A. Lunga, the Co-op. In Switzerland, Austria and Greece, all of their major retailers. In Belgium, some of the ones I've put up here, Delhaize-Laline, Coolright. In France, Carrefour, who are the largest retailer in Europe, all of them GE-free for their food products in the last 2 years. Now, I want to bring a quick message to farmers, if we have any in the audience, or I hope there's some this message will get out to, particularly to farmers in Canada and in America as well. The message is quite a simple one: don't grow what you can't sell. Canada's already lost its canola export market to Europe. America's already lost much of its corn export market for food products to Europe. America's also lost 2 to 3 million tons of its soya exports to Europe in the last couple of years. Brazil, where GE soya, for example, is still illegal, has picked up an extra 3 million tonnes of those lost business from America. And when I mention animal feed, it's not one that you'll be working on here yet. I think you should stick to the target of getting GE out of your normal food ingredients first. The animal feed stuff will come later, but there's a lot of genetically engineered soy that's exported from North America, from Canada and from America, goes into Europe for animal feed. During this summer, all of the major retailers are now taking GE soya, GE corn gluten feed out of their animal feed as well. America stands to lose another 6 million tonnes of soya exports to Europe. Canada stands to lose the rest of its soya exports to Europe unless farmers start to go GE free. So, I should cover one extra one there. Genetically engineered wheat, I hadn't had it on my list earlier, but someone was mentioning it this morning. Genetically engineered wheat is a big one that the biotech industry has on the horizon for Canada. The only question I would ask exporters or farmers in Canada is, quite where do you expect to sell this product? Certainly not in Europe. If they want to, and don't take my word for it, I'm biased. I'm now working for Greenpeace. 3 years ago, I didn't know anything about genetic engineering. It took me 3 years to learn that I wanted them banned so that they were never grown, and then I happily accepted the invitation to join Greenpeace. So I would say to farmers and exporters, don't believe me, I'm biased, but if you want to go to the UK and ask Warburtons or Rankovis or anybody else that buys Canadian wheat, and they'll tell you the same, there's no market for GE in Europe. So why did Europe, Japan, Brazil and so many other countries reject genetic engineering? I'll tell you in a wee second. That's a dramatic pause there. You ready? Okay, the biotech industry will tell you that it was the result of the BSE crisis. It's one of their favourite phrases here. It made the Europeans hypersensitive. They had the BSE crisis, so when this new wonderful technology, genetic engineering, came along, they'd already had some food scares. They got hypersensitive and, they've overreacted. They've kind of banned the stuff. Another thing they might tell you is that it was Greenpeace that were to blame. Greenpeace put on a couple of Frankenstein masks and got some photographs taken and scared everybody in Europe about genetically engineered foods. Didn't we do well? Let me tell you a wee bit of the truth about that. Yes, BSE contributed a little. BSE was yet another case of men in white suits, public relations professionals and compliant politicians telling people, don't worry, there's no problem, leave it to us, everything's fine. Oops, people are dying again. The chemical revolution, the chemical green revolution all over again. But it's the fact that there's been so many problems in the past. BSE was only the icing on the cake. We've all seen the problems before. So the fact that you've not had a BSE crisis makes no difference to my mind. If it's BSE, DDT, PCBs, GMO, if it's the FDA, the EPA, the USDA, or the CFIA, what's the difference? It's been an informed public in Europe which has rejected GMOs. We've had an amazing debate over the last 2 years. As people have learned about the issue, there's been a massive debate, and all of the facts were aired. Everybody had their opportunity. The biotech industry, Monsanto, took out their full-page adverts in every Sunday paper throughout Europe for a whole summer. The government published their reassuring propaganda. What happened was that as informed people started to take action about genetic engineering, as informed people started to demand the basic right to know, i.e. compulsory labelling of all GE foods, and as they demanded the basic freedom to choose, i.e. no contamination of organic and no contamination of conventional agriculture, then the food industry started to change. And once the food industry started to change because they were losing profits, then the media and then the politicians started to take notice. But it started with consumers. It started with us taking action. So, by now I hope you're also asking quite how easy it was to do that. What exactly did we do? What were the details? How did people get through to taking action? Well, it was, again, relatively easy. The first thing is that it was people like us that made it happen. I think you've got an enormous audience here tonight. During 1997, 1998, I'm sure half of the meetings I went to, we didn't have a tenth of the people in the room that you've got here. We just had lots of the meetings, but you've got a fabulous start in Canada. I don't think you're going to have any problem with the issue. For us, it was easy, and honestly, I really do say it was easy. I know we're facing big odds and we're big biotech companies and they've got all of the money and compliant governments. It was easy. We told people the facts about genetic engineering. We told them the basic facts. We'd let them know how they personally could do something about it. And what we've seen throughout the genetic engineering issue in Europe is that information plus options equals rejection. Give people information, give them the option of something that they can do about it, and people will reject genetic engineering. The biotech lobby have got a big problem. No matter how hard they try, they can't force people to eat genetically engineered foods. And it's at the level of food selling that we can make our voices heard. And I do apologise for such a prepared speech here, but bear with me. It's at the level of food selling that we can make our voices heard, and where the public, where we have the financial control of the market. They may control the seed market, they may control the propaganda, they may control the media, they certainly control the government, but we control the financial market for food. The people that buy the food control that market. In Europe, quite simply, we told people the facts about GE, then we told them which companies sold GE foods and which ones didn't. We highlighted both equally. We showed people that they could still buy organic. We pointed to the progressive companies that were excluding GE, and we pointed very firmly to the companies who were selling them GE foods. Food retailers and food manufacturers may be compliant, or they may be complacent about genetic engineering, but they're not the people that make money out of genetic engineering. That's your chemical companies and your Monsantos and your Novartis and your Aventis's. When food retailers and food manufacturers started to lose money in Europe because their customers were rejecting genetic engineering of food, that's when they started to sit up and take notice. That's when they started to sit up and listen. And that's when they started to stop buying genetically engineered crops. Now, let me address a wee cultural issue. Since I've been in Canada and America in the last few weeks, quite a lot of people tell me, oh, genetic engineering will never be rejected here. People here don't care about their food. They don't care about what they eat in the same way as the Europeans do. We don't have the same food culture over here that the Italians or the French do. Well, for those of you that have come in since my introduction and who might have missed, I'll just repeat that I'm from Scotland. Okay. In Scotland, we have a reputation for eating deep-fried Mars bars. But I have to tell you, Scotland was one of the first countries in Europe to reject genetically engineered food. In Scotland, we may still eat rubbish, but it's genetically engineered free rubbish. Now, if we can do it, you can do it. If Carrefour, Tesco, Safeway, Campbell's and Kellogg's in Europe can go GE-free, then so can Loblaws, Safeway, Campbell's and Kellogg's in Canada. When Kellogg's sell breakfast cereal with genetically engineered ingredients, when Kellogg's can't sell breakfast cereal with genetically engineered ingredients, then Kellogg's will stop buying genetically engineered corn. When Kellogg's stop buying genetically engineered corn, then farmers will stop growing genetically engineered corn. Greenpeace has produced a list of brands and retailers detailing what does and what doesn't contain genetically engineered ingredients. It's available on their website, which I should have the number of, but I don't. It'll be around, I'm sure. I'm not very good at pushing the Greenpeace name out there. I just care that we get GE out of food. As you may guess, we're targeting Kellogg's. It's one of our big targets for Greenpeace over the next year in Canada and America, and I hope you'll join us in targeting them as well, boycott their products, because that'll make them sit up and take notice. In both America and Canada, or just in summary, in both America and Canada, there's a growing awareness of genetically engineered foods. That growing awareness is already becoming a growing rejection of genetic engineering. The situation that you guys have got in Canada just now is the same situation that we faced. Word for word, same situation. In the course of 2 years, Europe went from being 60% GE contaminated to being GE free. And since I've been here in the last 6 weeks, I've looked at the consumer surveys, the media reports, I've spoken to major retailers, I've spoken to food manufacturers, I've spoken to farmers. I personally have absolutely no doubt that Canada will be GE-free. We faced the same difficulties in Europe, and we succeeded. As I see it, it's not a matter of when Canada will be it's not a matter of if Canada will be GE-free, it's a matter of when. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Lindsay. Denny Henke has traveled all the way from Memphis, Tennessee to participate in the teach-in. He utilizes the World Wide Web in his work, being the designer and maintainer of the Bioengineering Action Network website. He is also a spokesperson for Genetics Alert, an American activist media project. Highly involved in community resource groups, sustainable urban agriculture, and many social and ecological projects over the years, welcome Denny Henke.
Thanks for bringing me up here. It's been nice to get a taste of what civilization is like. Deep South is another world entirely, trust me. It's also been kind of fun to watch the election drama from up here. Ooh. All right, so I'm going to talk about the direct action aspect of the movement against genetics. Sort of give you an overall picture of what's been happening. I'm going to start off by talking a little bit, just very briefly, about the phenomena of the BBB, the pies, the flying pies, giving people their just desserts. November 23rd, 1998, Monsanto CEO Robert Shapiro was delivered a pie. In January the 24th, 2000, Canadian Minister of Health and also President of Biotech Coalition was given some pie at the Biosecurity Protocol Conference. And then in April, April 11th, the director of biotech at UC Davis was pied. And that's just a small group. The beauty of pieing as a form of direct action is that it's a way of saying to someone who is, you know, pretty separate from the rest of us, certainly they view themselves as separate and they have a certain level of power, and yet here they are eating some cream tofu. So I think it's an important way of saying to the people who are making these decisions pretty arrogantly, affecting our lives and affecting our ecosystems, you're human, you're touchable, and here you go. The direct action movement that has developed in North America, there was an action back, I believe it was in the 80s, but I want to talk mostly about the actions that have been happening here in the past, just in the past year and a half, really. There was an action July 28th, 1999 in Lodi, California, which Roundup Ready corn was pulled up and cut down. That would be the most, I would say that's the beginning of the modern era of crop destruction. And then the most recent would be October 11th, a group called Green Streets in UC Berkeley took out some corn. There have been five actions in BC that I'm aware of, all revolving around genetically engineered trees, genetic research regarding trees. there have been six, and I'm going to talk about one of those a little bit more in a few minutes. 16 actions in California involving corn, tomatoes, grape, strawberries, and wheat, melons, sunflowers. There have been two actions in Hawaii on corn and papaya, four actions in Minnesota, oats and corn, two actions in Maine involving corn and trees, one action in Long Island at the Cold Springs Harbor Laboratory, which involved corn, an action in Oregon involving grass at the Pure Seed testing facility, where they test for grass, which is turf for golf courses and such. One action in Washington, the state of Washington, involving canola. And two actions in Wisconsin involving pine trees. July 31st, year 2000, and the Dusty Desperados rode into the state of Washington, the town of Dusty. They eliminated 5 acres of Roundup Ready canola field tests that were being grown by Monsanto. Monsanto has 96 permits in Washington state alone for genetics. I have a quote from the communique that the Dusty Desperados released. Part of my job with a genetics alert, basically, communiques are sent to me anonymously and then I release them to the public. And this is a really good quote pulled from that communique by Robert Farley of Monsanto. He said, what you are seeing, this is in my handwriting, so I do everything on computer, so this is like another language for me. When I write, it's just, it's bad. What you are seeing is not just a consolidation of seed companies. It is really a consolidation of the entire food chain. And that is what it is. And I mean, that's, y'all have been hearing about it all day. Another action I wanted to mention, the Ministry of Forest Defense. It's an action that happened here in BC up in Saanich. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right. March 27th, year 2000, they destroyed hundreds of trees, coniferous trees. It was a test area. At the Ministry of Columbia Ministry of Forest, the Tree Improvement Branch, they were engineering the trees to be resistant to weevils. And that action coincided with Bio 2000, which was going on in Boston at the same time. They had thousands of protesters. Another action, this one happened in Mankato, Minnesota. This is the bolt weevils. They destroyed genetically engineered corn, test crops of corn. They also damaged trucks. They spray painted. One of the actions, in addition to the crop destruction, oftentimes the activists are spray painting buildings, spray painting trucks and that sort of thing, basically leaving behind messages that usually end up in photographs that end up in the media. In Belgium, in May of 2000, 200 people uprooted transgenic canola and maize, both belonging to Monsanto, at an experimental farm. And this sounded really fun, actually. Basically, the day started out with a conference. Then they had a picnic. And then they all sort of went up the road and took out this these crops. I've got a quote from the communique there that I wanted to share. Through this nonviolent collective action, we wish to relay in Belgium the growing international resistance to the imposition of transgenic exploitation of the earth. This exploitation indeed brings along heavy social, environmental, and sanitary risks, and is a logical follow-up to the disastrous effects of the subsidized agricultural production. Another action, this one in India, and this actually happened November 28th of 1998. This one's sort of famous. A lot of people probably heard of this. They called it Operation Cremation Monsanto. And basically, this farmer was growing BT cotton. He didn't know he was growing it. Monsanto had gone to him and said, here, we're going to give you some free seed. And they sort of helped the whole process along. I think they even went out to his fields and helped him in the fertilization process. He had no clue it was genetically modified cotton that he was growing. And they burned it. So actions in Scotland, there have been actions in the UK, actions in Ireland, France, June 23rd, 99, Korea, March 12th, 99, New Zealand, March 11th, 99. Again, most of these actions involve crop destruction, pulling up of crops, cutting down of crops. We recently got a video which is available to the public that is basically 2 minutes of footage of crops being cut down in California. And typically they use, you know, blades of some variety. Oftentimes they use poles, a couple people walking through the fields, knocking the crop over. Another group, well, actually, I just want to mention some of the names of the different groups. They're actually very interesting. Evidently, people like to have fun when they're naming their groups. Things like the WTO Welcome Committee, that happened, yeah, back around the time of Seattle. Reclaim the Genes, Genetics Goblins, Future Farmers of America, Reclaim the Seeds, the Petaluma Pruners, they cut down some great plants in Petaluma, California, the Earth Liberation Front, ELF. Probably the most active amongst these would be Reclaim the Seeds. They've gone in and they keep going back. Very brave. I wanted to get into discussing a bit the philosophy that motivates the direct action. I would say that the analysis coming from the direct action aspect of this movement is definitely it's a more radical critique. These are people that are not even sure that we should have capitalism. In fact, I would say, speculating that most of them are opposed to capitalism. And anarchists, woohoo! So many of the assumptions that might be made or accepted by the larger anti-genetics movement are not necessarily accepted by these folks, capitalism being one of them. Technology generally in this movement is far more critical. And, you know, it makes sense, really, when you get down to it, that in our society, supposedly, you know, the states claim to be, I know I was taught that I lived in a democracy, and I heard a quote recently that from Bush, the young Bush, about to hopefully, maybe, I don't know, we'll see, hopefully not get elected, but whatever, I don't know if that matters. America's greatest export is freedom, you know. Can you believe that? But just as silly as the notion that we're democracy. And I heard, you know, speakers throughout the day, you know, talking about this notion that these are democracies that we function within, and of course it's not true. But assuming that it were sort of true, you would think that in a democracy there would be information available, that it would be encouraged, that you would want your citizens to be informed, that you would want citizens to have access to the information so they could read and discuss and debate. Part of the democratic process. Well, that has certainly not been the case. In the States, the media, I mean, it's just been a complete blackout, whiteout, whatever you want to call it, of the information. It's just not been there. ask most people about genetics in the States, and they're just clueless. Go through the various mainstream publications that people tend to go to for information, looking for anything related to genetics, and with the exception of the Human Genome Project, you're not going to see anything. However, and this is one aspect, I would say one goal of the direct action movement, is to get the information out there. It's not always effective. Oftentimes the stories that are done in the media about the various direct actions, they're usually not very positive. Property is sacred in the States, you know, above and beyond life and ecological integrity, we must value property. And so when property destruction happens, usually the media takes a pretty negative slant on it. However, in doing that, they are talking about what it was that was destroyed. And oftentimes the information is getting out there, even if it's not in the most positive of ways or with the most positive of takes on the activism that brought it there. But it's getting out there. Another aspect, another reason for doing it, another goal of the direct actionists is economic sabotage, to basically say to these folks that are researching, that are growing these crops for production, that they're going to have to pay a price if they're going to continue growing it. If they're going to disregard the ecological integrity of the ecological systems, if they're going to disregard public health, then, and if, of course, you know, again, things I heard earlier today, you know, the FDA and the EPA, you know, of course they're not really monitoring what's going on. Their attitude is, you know, there's nothing that we need to be concerned about, and you have to show us a lot of evidence. It goes back to the presentation earlier on risk assessment. You're going to have to show us a lot of evidence before we're going to be concerned about this. Precaution is just thrown out the window. So activists have basically, you know, the whole philosophy of direct action is get into the process, muck it up, put the body on the line, as Henry David Thoreau discussed many years ago, and as Gandhi in, you know, India advocated, put your body on the line, put your body in the way, and basically don't accept what is told to us as this is the way it will be, and there is nothing you can do about it. You can go through the proper channels. You can go to these entities, and they'll watch out for your interests. Direct actionists have just decided that that is not going to happen. It's been tried, and it's typically failed. It's not to say it shouldn't happen. You know, I think labeling would be good. It's ridiculous. It's ludicrous that it hasn't already happened. And so, you know, it's an important part of the whole process. Yes, food should be labeled, but until we get foods labeled, and even after we get foods labeled, we need to be going out, if we're concerned with biological diversity, we need to be going out into the fields and taking care of business. Now, that said, I would say that there is a real limitation to the actual, you know, if the goal of the activists is to protect the environment, and I would say that that is certainly one of the goals. It is seen not as violence or not as property destruction. If there are any vandals, if there's anyone being violent, direct actionists perceive it to be Monsanto that is violent, and it is Monsanto and Novartis and whoever else in the list, they are the vandals. This is an act of property, I mean, this is an act of ecosystem protection. Now, there's no way that activists have, at this point, they're not even close to really protecting the ecosystems. There's way too much planted in the States, way too much in North America, to really protect the environment directly. It could be argued, and I think it would be right to argue, that there are indirect effects. Again, it goes back to getting information into the media system that would otherwise not be there, and also forcing them to work harder. You know, the universities are having to install extra security. As I mentioned earlier, the Reclaim the Seeds have continued to go back into different facilities, and it seems as though each time they go back, there's more security that's been installed. That security costs money. It's not enough to go to our congresspeople, our legislators, and ask them to protect us. It's not enough to petition, to write. I mean, I think that we should do those things, but there's a whole other level. And then real briefly before I step down, I wanted to mention that another aspect of all of this in terms of direct action is that we, and I think this is a real strong current within the direct action movement, is that we have to really develop an understanding with our food. We don't have that. It's gone. We go to the grocery store, almost everyone I know, their relationship with their food happens in the grocery store, this sterile, ugly environment where they're buying products that, even if they're reading the ingredients, they're probably not understanding some of them. Even if they order from a food co-op, they're getting food that they have very little connection with in terms of its production. Direct action is also getting into your ecosystem, I would say, and growing your own food or making an effort to grow some of your own food. Looking at the, you know, there needs to be a criticism of the overall agricultural system, which is about profit, and it's not about meeting human needs. It's about making money. It's about increasing the profits of the stockholders. We need to be thinking about our relationship with the birds and the bees and the stink bugs that are eating our squash. We need to have a more concrete relationship with this planet of ours. So that's, I think, is what's going to be gone into next.
Next up is Kathleen Neen. She's a British Columbian activist who has worked across Canada with various community groups. She's well known in our province at the present time for her work creating local food policy groups. From the Shuswap country in the interior of BC, Kathleen edits, illustrates, designs, and co-writes The Ram's Horn, a newsletter dedicated to providing a critical and independent account of the biotechnology industry. Kathleen.
Thank you very much. But I did want to start out by reminding you of something that Brewster said at the beginning, because I think that the day has illustrated it very well. He said that he thought that the famous double helix of the DNA has two strands. Really, one of them is DNA, and the other one is TNC, the transnational capital. And it is that diabolical linking and the effects of that linking on our lives and in our most intimate persons that we've been talking about all day. And now we're at the point where, as the questioner after the first panel said, okay, so now what are we going to do? What are we going to do? There's enough talk already. This was at the beginning of the day. Whew. What are we going to do? What do we do with all this information? And there's been an amazing amount of it. What do we do with the inspiration of people who have stood on this panel, on this platform, people who we all know have been giving their lives to the struggle for the integrity of the planet? How do we honor the work of people like, and I don't want to pick out anybody in particular, but people like Gregor Walbring, people like Beth Burroughs, people like Doreen Stavinsky, people who have done all this work and traveled here to tell us about it? What are you going to put on your to-do list when you go home? I think that there's two questions that we have to ask ourselves. One of them is, how do we stop them? And the previous two speakers on this panel have just given us some pretty good ideas. And the other question is, how do we survive in the process? And I'd like to suggest to you that these are not contradictory things, that as one of my heroes, Kay McPherson, famously said, when in doubt, do both. My own personal history, I was one of those Band the Bomber kids back in the 60s. That's where I cut my political teeth. And I remember vividly trying to struggle with a situation where nuclear weapons were completely safe. Nothing could possibly go wrong. The It was absolutely essential that we had mutually assured destruction, MAD, they actually called it that, to defend ourselves from the communist threat, which was either the red or the yellow menace, depending on which color was in fashion at the time. After Chernobyl, after Three Mile Island, the promise of nuclear power, which was so cheap that they wouldn't have to meter it, lost some of its, if I may use the expression, glow. And we started to get more skeptical, but not perhaps skeptical enough. And when I face the issues that have been raised by the emerging biotechnology industry, I get this sense of deja vu. You know, I've been here before. But there are some differences. One of them, as Doreen Stabinski pointed out, is that unlike the products of nuclear fission, which have a half-life but do eventually disappear, the products of biotechnology are living organisms, cheerily mutating and reproducing, completely beyond the power of humanity to control them. But there's another difference which I find actually more interesting, and that is that back in those days, when I was a baby activist, we marched and we protested, and there's people still doing it, people like the Berrigans who are still getting thrown in jail for doing this stuff. There wasn't a whole lot that we could do directly about stopping the nuclear arms race, besides lobbying our politicians and marching and protesting. But when you get to biotechnology, interestingly enough, and I think that's the message that I've gotten out of today, there are some very practical, concrete things that every single one of us can do without even stretching very far. Because it's all about forcing us, as Lindsay said, forcing us to eat what they want us to eat. Forcing us to accept, as Gregor said earlier, forcing us to accept their definitions of humanity. And they can put it out there all they like, but they can't make us eat it. They can't force us to define ourselves by their definitions. Which means, in practical terms, we don't have to depend. We really don't have to depend on Safeway and Overweighty and the Western Empire to feed ourselves. We can feed ourselves. Here in British Columbia, I mean, it's ridiculous. We have the most amazing productive capacity here. We've got a climate unlike anywhere else in, you know, north of the 49th parallel. We can grow all kinds of things here. And we can trade for the things that, well, maybe pineapples, as Ellen said, but personally, the things that always appeal to me are the breakfast stuff, you know, the oranges and the coffee. I really would like to be able to trade for. But there's nothing wrong with trade as long as it's in the context of self-reliance. Feed the family first. Feed ourselves first. And then we can trade the leftovers, no problem. I don't have any difficulty with selling apples to Europe or to Japan when we've already got as many apples as we can eat in British Columbia and we've got a wonderful climate to grow them in. What I object to is being bamboozled into eating apples that come from somewhere else when we could be eating apples that are growing on the tree down the road. There is nothing stopping us, nothing stopping us from creating a sustainable, local, healthy food system here in British Columbia, and across Canada for that matter, or anywhere else in the world, which is based on the notion that what is grown locally is what you choose to eat. Okay. One of the important things about this is that when you eat local, you are also doing a whole lot of other things. You're creating a community, because food is famously part of culture. We were arguing the other night, is there any culture that does not wrap meat or vegetables in a dough and either bake it or fry it? Wontons, kreplach, you know, whatever, spring rolls. Everybody does something of the sort. They're all called different things, but it's a very similar kind of exercise. Peoples everywhere have cultural ways of feeding themselves. And the celebration of the food and of the season is something which has been central to human culture since time immemorial. So that's one piece. But another piece, and I think it's perhaps more directly in the line of what we've been talking about today, is the appalling threat to biodiversity of the genetic engineering industry. I try very hard not to let myself think about this, because when I do, I tend to get kind of emotional. And it's probably appropriate to be emotional about the potential demise of the planet, but it tends to lower your credibility when you start snuffling and crying because it's all going to go. But it is all going to go. But there's something you can do about it. If the problem is that seeds are being patented, seeds are and taken out of public ownership, then you and you and I can take a heritage seed and grow it out in a pot on your balcony, in a vacant lot in town, on your farm, in your garden. We can all do this. This is not rocket science. It's very sophisticated. If you get into actual seed saving, it's extremely sophisticated, but it's not something that we can't all do. So in some ways, I'd like to present that as a symbolic act, which is also extremely practical. And I think that when we think about our list of to-dos when we go home, that's the characteristic that I think it's important for us to hang on to. I think we need to do things which connect with the evil out there. Things which clearly describe what is wrong with genetically engineering our food supply and attempting to improve ourselves. And at the same time, I think we need to be doing things which are very practical and which are healing for ourselves personally and for the communities we live in. So growing seeds is an obvious one, but there's lots of other ones. If the purpose and the method of the genetic engineering, in food at least, is to make us completely dependent on outside forces for our food, and to make a class distinction among those who can afford to buy handcrafted organic food and those who are going to eat genetically engineered crap, and that is not my vision, but it's certainly one that's been put forward, then we overcome that by creating food systems locally where there are direct relationships between producers and consumers and where we know each other, so that the farmer's market, the community kitchen, the community gardens, the gleaning programs where fruit trees are harvested and the produce is processed and used in the community, the good food box, where people get together in buying clubs who do not have a lot of buying clout and maximize their capacity to buy food that is good for them because they're clubbing their money together. All these things are ways of creating a food system which is simply not able to be controlled by Safeway or Weston's or Overweighty. I remember when Brewster started researching Cargill, and people kept saying, aren't you afraid? And he said, no. These guys are like dinosaurs. They've got very big feet. And if you happen to be in a place where they're stepping, too bad for you. But there's lots of room to run around the edges. And when they go away, which they will. Let me be absolutely clear about this. This evil technology, this attempt to control the earth through what is called science, this attempt to manipulate the stuff of life, will fail. It is not tenable. We may all go down with it, but it is not going to happen. In the long term, the earth will not be able to tolerate this kind of abuse. What she will do, I don't know, but that she will rise up and destroy it, I'm absolutely certain. And what I think we have to do is two things. One is we have to be very strategic and very thoughtful about how we can make sure that that happens before the entire planet is destroyed. And the other thing is to prepare ourselves so that when it does happen, we will have the systems in place which will enable the human species to survive. So, what do we do? Practically now, I mean, that's all very grandiose. There's a little booklet which is on the Farm Folk City Folk table over in the other room, which I would strongly recommend that you pick up, and if you have $2 toward the printing costs, that would help too. It's called A Consumer's Guide to Ingredients Which May Have Been Genetically Engineered, or How to Become a Detective in Your Own Food System. In other words, you can avoid eating genetically engineered foods. You can bully the people who are trying to sell them to you. You can contact the manufacturers. And this is very effective. You know, people like Frito-Lay didn't just stop, or McCain's, didn't just stop using genetically engineered ingredients because they thought, perhaps for some theoretical reason, that the consuming public didn't want it. It's because they got lots and lots of phone calls and emails and postcards and letters. They've told us that. Okay. Lobby your politicians. I know that they're a fairly useless lot by and large. Sorry, Bill, but nonetheless, their job is to represent us. So tell them what they need to do in words of one syllable. BCGE free. It's easy to remember. Don't be afraid of speaking to the principal. If you don't know enough about Codex, that's okay. You can say that you want your food to be clean. It's up to them to figure out how to do it. Use every opportunity to talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors, talk to groups. If you need information, you've just met a dazzling array of people who've got lots and lots of information for you. And on the other side of things, eat well and enjoy your food. And remember that the earth is abundant and generous. And celebrate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. We have a couple people at the mic. If you want to go ahead right here.
My name's Chris Shannon. This question's for Denny. How does one go about finding where these test sites are?
That's a really good question. I actually haven't done that sort of thing myself, but you can go to this particular website. Doesn't really have that information, but it would be a good place to go. You'll find the Nighttime Gardener's Guide there. It's a tao.ca/BAN. That's the Bioengineering Action Network. So you might check out the Nighttime Gardener's Guide there. I live in Memphis. I know where there are some things going on, and obviously, being a spokesperson, I would never go near them. But you get to know your community, get to know your neighborhood, and be out. It's sort of a surface answer. You just have to dig. But you can also, I think that's about all I can say at this point.
The microphone here?
Yes, to Lindsay. I'm Bill Fowler from Victoria. And I'd like you to comment on the role of labeling in Europe. You know, it seemed that you didn't spend much time on that, and I guess that it didn't play, you know, an important role here, whereas a lot of our activity is geared towards labeling. So, I mean, I know that the political circumstances are different, but how much effort do you think that we should be placing on labeling when we really want to ban?
I think it is important to call for labeling. A lot of people that it takes people an hour, in my experience, it took people a while to start to get their head around what is genetic engineering. It took me a while to get my head around what is genetic engineering and then to come to a decision for me personally what I wanted to happen about genetic engineering. I think most people can very easily understand that as a minimum they should have the freedom to choose. So I think in terms of communicating a message about genetic engineering, I've never met anybody except compliant politicians and biotech industry people that would refuse people the basic right to a freedom of choice. So I think there's a good strong argument to take out there to the public that everybody can understand. If you don't have that freedom of choice, what's the reason that that's not there? So I would continue campaigning for labelling. However, the reality in Europe was that actually by the time we got the regulations for labelling, once they came into place, by the time they had come into place, we had already won the issue because we had targeted all of the main food companies and people had stopped buying their product. So the labelling came in a little bit late in the day. So I would say it's important, but more important is contacting those food companies and making sure that they know that you won't buy their product if it contains GE.
Quick question here.
First, let me say that there's a lady here who has compiled a list of numbers of different CEOs and heads of different corporations that put out GE Foods that she'll be handing them out in the lobby. My question was that as far as activist tactics in Europe, what did you find in direct action actually was the most efficient in getting out the message?
Well, there was a variety of direct action. Obviously, there were quite a number of field trials in and around the UK where people targeted those field trials. Field trials are a direct release to the environment of GM. A lot of the time it's even the more controversial genetically engineered crops, so there was a lot of direct action. You saw quite a lot of citizens' groups getting together in areas where there were field trials and people did pull up those field trials. Greenpeace, as you may know, pulled up a field trial of genetically engineered maize last year. We were subsequently found not guilty of causing any criminal damage for doing that, and the reason for that was that a jury of our peers, the public who sat in a jury, decided that actually we had a perfect right to do that because it was stopping contamination of the environment. That was the legal judgment. And, but I think it is also targeting food companies. As I say, food retailers, food manufacturers don't make any money out of genetic engineering. Quite why some of them are as compliant or as complacent as they are, I've never worked out. But if you go to your local Safeway every day or every week and you load up your trolley with goods and you take them to the checkout and stack it high, and when you get to the checkout, ask them if it's genetically engineered. And if it's not genetically engineered, maybe you don't want to buy it at that point. Now, if they can't sell produce because there's too many people complaining, they won't sell genetically engineered foods.
Okay, one last question.
Hello, my name's Edward. My question's for Lindsay. I'm a really young activist, and this question's really important to me. By what means was the European citizenry educated so thoroughly about GE Foods prior to boycotts and other action-oriented refusals to GE Foods? Because I know direct action and boycotts and all that is education, but in order to mobilize people, I think you know what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked because it's a very good question. All I would suggest is use the networks that already exist. Don't try and reinvent the wheel. You've got great information. We've got slightly too much information. You've heard some great speakers and some great organisations here today. We've got great information on websites. We've got great fact sheets available. The key is getting them out there. Don't let's be talking to each other about the issue. You know, don't let's all be applauding each other in the back and all going to meetings where it's all the same faces and we're all saying, rah, 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 how good we're doing about this genetic engineering. I'm convinced, we're all convinced, let's take the message out. Use the networks that exist. So you'll have parents' organisations, you'll have women's groups. We were visiting everything from the Mothers and Toddlers group to the Butterfly Conservation Societies. We realised quite early on that beekeepers would be affected, for example, by their bees feeding on genetically engineered canola and oilseed rape. So we went to all of the beekeepers in the UK. I was amazed. There are tens of thousands of people who quietly go on with their life and do nothing else except keep bees. And they're wonderful, they play a wonderful part in all of our agriculture, but they weren't going to ever be prominent about genetic engineering, and they had never joined Greenpeace, they would never join Friends of the Earth, and they were never involved in any of the other organisations that are maybe sat around this table. You've got to go out and find them and plug into their networks. People do want to know about it. That was the intrinsic thing. Everybody that we were telling wanted the information. But let's not talk to ourselves about it. Let's take it out, find new faces, think of new organisations and go out and tell them. That's the key.
You've been listening to a panel, Sowing the Seeds of Empowerment, from the Big Money Bad Science Conference on Biotechnology, recorded in Vancouver, Canada last month. Special thanks to the Vancouver Independent Media Centre for that tape. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. Coming up in our next hour, Ithaca College students confront private prison industry profits, and a local talk show host takes Cornell University to court over freedom of information.